Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello, and welcome to Bookworm. My name is Michael Silverblatt, and today I'm very honored and pleased to have with me as my guest the poet Jory Graham to talk about her newest book, Swarm, which is published by the Echo imprint at HarperCollins. I want to report a very unusual and very moving experience that occurred to me in connection with this book. I knew that I would be talking to Jory Graham about Swarm. I had read it twice, had been impressed by the beauty and spareness of the line, and I remembered what Ezra Pound said about a certain kind of poetic line, that it's like hard scrabble, that the line should be etched deeply into the ground of the text, and hers were. But I found myself thinking that it had been derived from a kind of language poetry that I didn't necessarily understand, but intuitively knew the depth and beauty of. Imagine my surprise when I opened the book again to read it from the beginning, and what the book's jacket said turned out to be true. All of the small poems cohered into one large poem. The implications and resonances of that large poem seemed vast and unimaginable. Suddenly, I felt like I was reading, really, the closest thing to it was coming to an understanding of how the four quartets worked together, that the poems were spiritual, are spiritual, and in particular, that they have as a sort of common subject for spiritual meditation that moment when, at the sounding of the last judgment, the soul will rejoin its body. And so the swarm, to my mind, is the swarm of souls awaiting reincorporation, awaiting their bodies. And we get news of the various waiting rooms, limbos, circles of hell in which these souls have been living for centuries. The sounds, the corridors, the waiting bells of souls now swarming their way forward toward an amalgamation and a union nearly unimaginable to them, as this book-length poem presents a vision of brokenness and union unimaginable in most contemporary American poetry. Most poetry. Jory, a project like this seems enormous and unfulfillable. How can you describe its impulses and how you started?
Well, your description is so beautiful, and I believe that this notion of many voices as opposed to a single voice animates the book in a way that you've described most movingly and intelligently. I think it's one of the things that might be most difficult about the book, since we're used to having, especially in poetry, no matter how much we think of the poem being written by a persona, even in a dramatic poem, an active speaker other than the poet, there is the illusion in poetry that the poet is always speaking to us and that it's a single lyric voice. And the sense of the personal relationship of that address, the sense of the news, as Pound would also say, being delivered directly by the poet into the ear of the listener, and the lyric being that kind of a personal communication, is so built into one's pleasures in reading poetry that I think one of the things that was disturbing about this book for me, even in attempting to put it together, and I think is perhaps disturbing to some readers, is the sensation of not quite knowing who's speaking in it. And also the sensation that without a dramatis personae of, you know, that a play would, you know, have listed for you in the front, the sense of multiple speakers speaking, sometimes mm-hmm. even within a single poem, a choral kind of speech, and that different kinds of utterances that are not marked off as being attributable to one person or another come at you as the reader, and did to me as the writer and receiver of the poems, in different tones of voice, so that the issue of resurrection, which you bring up, I think, so wonderfully, gets located in this sensation of not knowing who you are enough to know which of the utterances that are crossing through your body are so-called personal, which ones are communal or born of your sense of commonality, which ones are transmitted through you by a deity, which ones are transmitted through you by law, which ones are transmitted through you by habit, and trying to find a self that will be able to contain all of those speaking voices and still be a singular self enough to be incarnated and suffer existence and be judged was part of the complex experience I had in writing the book. I think it's possible without having to understand exactly who's speaking to accept in reading the poems that sometimes things that are instructions or appear to be instructive in mode in the book, as in statements that say, you know, touch pain with great curiosity, or forego explanation, or explain delay, explain door ajar, are not statements addressed by a lyric speaker in the traditional sense to a writer, I mean to a reader, excuse me, saying, you know, hey, you, explain this or explain that to me since I don't understand it. But it's actually a set of voices coming at the speaker.
Yes.
That the speaker is trying to make a kind of organized sense out of.
Even instruction to the poet, that the poet in transcribing, in channeling this flux, may need to be instructed to explain certain things later on. Maybe not in that poem, but in a voicing later still.
I think it corresponds to an experience that we all have in the culture right now that's quite moving and disturbing at the same time, and that is, we are constantly overhearing pieces of language that come to us and that we incorporate and then use. We also are ourselves speaking pieces of language that come back at us reused. People who are lovers, parents, children are constantly reinventing a language that's a personal language that they use at each other, for each other, through each other. Advertising puts language into our heads that we don't know what to do with. Religious institutions put phrases into our heads that are supposed to be salvational and we don't know what to do with them. Political jargon puts ideas into our head that become part of our personal vocabulary. So the sense of there being a non-communal multiplicity of instructions that we then try to cohere in any given day and make up a self that can be moral and spiritual and responsive is sort of, I think, this debris field that the speaker of the book is operating in.
I'm so happy to hear you articulate this, because when we first spoke about this book some months ago in Santa Fe, it was at a point when the book had not yet been received. I was full of ideas about it, and I was happy to have some of them confirmed and some of them deferred. But what you told me that was very interesting at the time was that you had completed, after completing the manuscript, a final poem which you felt brought the whole together, and that you had had to go back to the publisher, Echo, at HarperCollins. The book is Swarm, by my guest, Jory Graham, and ask them to incorporate this final poem into the whole. Can you describe
that experience, because it does seem like the experience of a revelation when the job seems to have been over.
The sense that this book wasn't finished in the phrase, "We exist, meet me," which is the penultimate ending, though it was very haunting. And I needed, in some sense, to have Eurydice come back from the dead and make song that was intact and whole. The book is, you know, as you pointed out, if the book is in fragments, it's because the speaker is putting things back together, not because the speaker is taking things apart. And because of the ways in which radio waves still hold in the outer universe everything that was ever said, I presume.
Lingers in the air.
Lingers in the air.
Is recapturable. That's the belief that the poem has.
And, you know, that's what literary, or just the history of what's written in the language, feels like to anyone who's a reader. There's no book that you read that isn't filled with the echoes of prior books. There's no instruction that your parent gives you that isn't filled with instructions that come from their parents and the legends that were told to them as truth, or the motives that were told to them as undeferrable and inarguable. I mean, there is no one who hasn't lived the myth of the House of Atreus. We all move from the state of sort of childhood belief to a kind of extraordinary fracturing disbelief and attempt to be resurrected into an adult life in which the fragments shored against our ruin are put back together. The two images that stayed with me, I think in a way that have come back to haunt me since I finished the book, that involve the ear and what's poured into the ear, is of course the way Hamlet's father is killed, and the incredible feeling that Hamlet has constantly in that play of things that come in through the ear that ground in him and that sort of cul-de-sac in him and that can't come back out as action. The ways in which the ghost's instructions to him ground in him and he can't act, the ways in which the ghost's narrative is not trusted entirely and he needs verification, the way in which every single piece of language uttered by anybody in the play seems to have two and three and four meanings that come out either in comic form, in Polonius's reuse of certain words to the point where they become comic, or the ways in which Hamlet obsessively puns because the words seem to have double and triple meanings and he can't make them steady and still enough in order to allow him to coalesce a right set of instructions that will allow him to act.
And so that the words themselves swarm.
Yes.
And over-cohere and under-cohere
exactly. In
their densities.
But I don't think it's a peculiar poetic problem. I think the reason that I keep bringing up experiences in life that are outside of literature is that even though this seems like a very poetic project because it's involved with the history of poetry as well, I think it's an experience that we all have and that is increasing, not decreasing. And it doesn't have to do with the simple fragmentation of contemporary life, but it has as much to do with multiple realities being so true at the same time, which is really what traps Hamlet, because love and anger and fate and revenge and compassion and a sense of disbelief and a mistrust of language, finally, but a mistrust of what language conveys and of language capacity to convey it.
So in other words, in that line, how all occasions do
inform against me.
Inform against me. It's not just; it's the swarm of possibility, not single opponents, but the sum total of them, which is much. Not only what an individual in a culture feels about the weight of the tradition that precedes him, but what a poet feels, ultimately, that many, many, many poems are beautiful and meaningful to a poet, but that as a whole, they are unlikely to cohere.
But I think also the attempt to hold all these things together at once is a strengthening spiritual exercise, so that the reading of poetry for me is about the way things are centrifugal and they fly apart in the ways in which, say, to oversimplify it, form and content are usually telling me contradictory stories, and then the ways in which I bring them together and hold them in solution unsolved, so that I can myself be a person who can be rational and irrational. I can be a person who can both dream and reason. I can be a person who can both believe one thing and its opposite, reality and justice in one thought, as Yeats would have it. And that contradiction is not only helpful and enlivening, but it's not ultimately paralyzing. And I think that one of the things that moves me so deeply about Hamlet and is the fact that, in the end, not acting for Hamlet, which is often thought of in the play as a failure of character, becomes a truly profound action. The earlier law would say, kill the king who killed the prior king. The later law might say, undergo the experience of suffering that this dismemberment of your personal self is the payment for, but do not act to disrupt the state any further.
The polis, yes. Mm.
And that, you know, that's very much sort of what happens at the end of the Agamemnon, which is, you know, one of the things that interests me, of the Oresteia, sorry, that interests me in the book. The position of the watchman at the beginning of the Agamemnon, and I have a long poem in his voice, in his point of view, is of great interest to me, because as long as he's waiting to find out for those long 10 years whether the war at Troy has gone to the Greeks or to the Trojans, and waiting to see the bonfires lit along the whole length of the Peloponnese, he is in a kind of historical abeyance. He's in a place where outcome is not known, and therefore cause is waiting for effect, but cause and effect have this wonderful, lingering, open moment. And in that moment, in each individual life, is sometimes overlooked. The idea that we are supposed to be able to choose and organize our inner lives, and whether it's on the spiritual level or the political level or the level of, you know, the personal life, with it, we are supposed to know enough information and gather enough to have a self.
So in other words, this watchman who will give the word to Clytemnestra, she will launch into immediate, resolute action of retaliation, whereas the position of the speakers in this poem is of the watching of the constellation, the waiting for the news.
Of all the possible conditions we can be in, and Lord knows I've written many poems that are about action and mental action, the attempts to grasp and understand and know and recount and persuade. There's also a state in our lives, and it might be a state that culturally we need to be more aware of now, which is one in which we don't have to go into some New Age position to understand that there is a state in which not acting,
watching and waiting.
Waiting and listening, and a state of readiness, but not readiness to spring, but readiness to the hand over the throat, as
yes,
you just indicated.
Removing the hand from the throat.
In some case, it means, though, so much coming into you, and you not yet being able to let it back out as song, that as it gets trapped in you, it also makes you half crazy, so that you start hearing multiple voices. I mean, there is an aspect to the kind of thing I'm talking about, which is not entirely spiritually healthy. It's also a crisis condition.
So, in other words, these poems that you've written over your career, which have been in many senses before this, poems of separation, of Adam and Eve from Paradise, of Orpheus from Eurydice, of Demeter from Persephone, these are now recognitions that separations are also abeyances, that there is an awaiting of the return of union, and that it is all, in fact, a configuration of union, of potential union.
Of presence,
of
yes.
Of presence.
Of presence, and that the binary opposition, presence and absence, it might be something that we have to look at again, that we might be able, we seem to think culturally, you know, just think of us as a nation, that the only way to be present is to act. And the only way to be present is to be known. The only way to be present culturally is to be famous or to be recognized. And there are ways to be present which have to do, I think the locating of it at the moment of the Day of Judgment is very wise on your part and very moving to me that you recognize that. Because there's what is asked of one at the moment when one is recoalescing oneself into a self is in fact a presence without the animal leaping into action that we recognize as thought even. There is a beautiful theological notion involving presence that I once read when I was much younger and that moved me and scared me deeply as a child. I don't remember the name of the theologian, but he was writing about how everything in nature has no option but to be present. A tree has to be present, as he put it, to the very edges of its outer core. Only the human being can pull back the spirit from the edges of its physical being and withdraw into a state where it's not fully present. And that the only true obligation of the spiritual life, regardless of one's religious beliefs, had to do with attempting to be fully present at any given moment in the world. And I remember hearing about this when I was sort of a young teenager and being terrified by those days when I wouldn't be in school and my name would be called out. And the teacher, because it was a French lycée, and they would say my name and someone would call out in French, absente, you know, absent. And I would be at home thinking, I don't want the word absent to come, you know, next to my name. You know, I don't want to be absent. And there's a way in which this book attempts to negotiate between sometimes overwhelming presence on the part of the speaker, attempting to be present, more present by taking actions, attempting to be completely absent so as to not damage and not through empire, for example, the empire of the imagination, take control of and overwhelm with language, mental action, spiritual action, the objective world. So retreating into extreme subjectivity, forcing oneself upon the world in extreme states of objectivity or attempts at knowing, and then finding some balance in between where non-action isn't inaction. Mm. And does that make sense?
Absolutely. I wanted to continue by asking my guest, Jory Graham, to read, and by the way, I want to acknowledge that she is a Pulitzer Prize winner for her selected poems, The Dream of the Unified Field, poems 1974 to 1994. And I wanted to ask Jory Graham to read the first poem, In Swarm, which gives you the state of spirit, soul, disembodiment. The poem is called From the Reformation Journal, and the poet, Jory Graham.
From the Reformation Journal, of course, I literally am attempting to use that word reformation in a few different ways, as in reforming ourselves out of perhaps a way in which we took ourselves apart. The wisdom I have heretofore trusted was cowardice, the leaper. I am not lying. There is no lying in me. I surrender myself like the sinking ship, a burning wreck from which the depths will get theirs when the heights have gotten theirs. My throat is an open grave. I hide my face. I have reduced all to lower case. I have crossed out passages. I have severely trimmed and cleared. Locations are omitted. Uncertain readings are inserted silently. Abbreviations silently expanded. A he referring to God may be capitalized or not, is crying now. Show me, is crying now. What's wrong in a strange tree of atoms, of too few, more, no wonder. Give me the glassy ripeness. Give me the glassy ripeness in failure. Give me the atom laying its question at the bottom of nature. Send word. Clear fields. Make a formal event. Walk. Turn back. Reduce all to lowercase. have reduced all. Cross out passages. Have inserted silently. Is there a name for glassy ripeness in failure? Born and raised. And you? Go back. Need more. Having lived it leaves it possible. Fear. Lamentation. Shame. Ruin. Believe me. Explain. Given to. Explain. Born of. Absence is odious to God. I'm asking. Unseen, unseen, the treasure unperceived. Unless you compare, the treasure may be lost. Oh, my beloved, I'm asking. More atoms, more days, the noise of the sparrows of the universals. Yet colder here now than in the atom still there at the bottom of nature, that we be founded on infinite smallness, which occasions incorruption or immortality. Incorruption because already as little as it can be, escape square, wasted square, safety square, hopeless square, to all except anguish, the mind soon adjusts. Have reduced, have trimmed, have cleared, have omitted. Have abbreviations silently expanded. To what avail? Explain asks to be followed. Explain remains to be seen.
Jory Graham, reading from the Reformation or Reformation Journal from her new book, Swarm, published by Echo, HarperCollins. Jory Graham is for me easily the most exciting of the poets of her generation in America, one of the most interesting poets writing in the world now. Swarm is a profound and enormous and even unimaginable achievement to me, and I want to thank you for telling me so much about it and instructing me so deeply.
Well, thank you. Actually, you instructed me as well, so it was fun.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse Club Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.